Are any of Canada's political parties up to the task of addressing the climate crisis? What basic assumptions do governments and even activists typically make that undermines an effective response? What are the necessary steps our communities must take if abrupt climate disruption can be mitigated? Are such steps even possible given current political and economic realities? Are they enough? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with Canadians going to the polls in a federal election in less than a month, we look at one of the most important issues facing the nation and the world, namely climate change, and at least one possible formula for confronting it. We'll hear from Avi Lewis, one of the architects of the LEAP Manifesto and director of a recent film on climate change, and we'll hear from Dar Jamail, author of the monthly Climate Disruption Dispatches for Truth Out. On this week's program, Taking the Leap, Climate Policy in the Canadian Elections. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 25th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. All U.S. presidents, at least since World War II, were unindicted war criminals, Obama the latest in a long line of rogue leaders reflecting America's odious history, systematically pursuing empire, ravaging and destroying one country after another, remaining unaccountable for his high crimes. Whoever succeeds him in 2017 will continue the same reckless policies, maybe overstepping enough to launch World War III, potential Armageddon if occurs. All presidential aspirants from both parties favor endless wars of conquest. Maintaining America's menacing military global footprint is prioritized. Its empire of bases, its alliances with other rogue states, its rage to dominate unchallenged, the greatest threat to world security and stability. No nation threatens them more than America. None more likely to start global war. None more greatly endangering humanity's survival. That comes from the article, America, the World's Greatest Threat, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 23rd. Russia's veto power is an important tool able to prevent Washington from getting legitimacy for its imperial wars. The Security Council will lose its relevance without it, Moscow's UN envoy Vitaly Churkin explained. It would, quote, simply rubber stamp decisions made in Washington, Paris, London, and Brussels. It would prevent SC members from doing the important work of bringing about consensus decisions, unquote. U.S. administrations under Republicans and Democrats are the greatest threats to world peace. It'll take more than Security Council actions to rein in their madness. That comes from the article, Understanding the UN Security Council Veto Power, America Threatens Russia, also by Stephen Lendman, posted September 24th. India, South Africa, and Brazil have decided not to go along with a multiple currency arrangement, which would have allowed for the development of bilateral trade and investment activities between BRICS countries operating outside the realm of dollar-denominated credit. In fact, they did not have the choice of making this decision in view of the strict loan conditionalities imposed by the IMF. Heavily indebted under the brunt of their external creditors, all three countries are faithful pupils of the IMF World Bank. The central bank of these countries is controlled by Wall Street and the IMF. for them to enter into a non-dollar or an anti-dollar development banking arrangement with multiple currencies would have required prior approval of the IMF. That comes from the article BRICS and the Fiction of De-dollarization by Professor Michel Chossadovsky, posted September 23rd. Russian President Vladimir Putin has thrown U.S. policymakers what amounts to a lifeline to pull them out of the quicksand that is the Syrian war. But official Washington's neocons and the mainstream U.S. news media are growling about Putin's audacity and challenging his motives. For instance, the New York Times lead editorial on Monday accused Putin of, quote, dangerously building up Russia's military presence, unquote, in Syria, even though Putin's stated goal is to help crush the Sunni jihadists in the Islamic State and the other extremist movements. Instead, the Times harumphs about Putin using his upcoming speech to the United Nations General Assembly, quote, to make the case for an international coalition against the Islamic State, apparently ignoring the one already being led by the United States, unquote. The dreamy Times neocon prescription continues to be that regime change, quote-unquote, in Damascus would finally lead to the emergence of the mythical moderate, quote-unquote, rebels who would somehow prevail over the far more numerous and far better armed extremists. This perspective ignores the fact that after a $500 million training project for these quote-unquote moderates, the U.S. military says four or five fighters are now on the battlefield inside Syria. That comes from the article, Will U.S. Grasp Putin's Syria Lifeline? By Robert Perry, posted September 23rd, originally appearing at Consortium News. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Climate change dilemma has gotten scant, if any, attention in the current Canadian election campaign. The journal PLOS One reports that half the birds on the North American continent could lose their home range by the end of the century due to climate impacts. Abrupt climate disruption is generating climate refugees as sea levels rise and wildfires rage around the world. And a recent document prepared by the World Wildlife Fund and the Zoological Society of London reported that climate change impacts have driven the die-off of nearly half of all marine life since 1970. And the next 2 years are expected to be the hottest on record, according to the UK Meteorological Office. So what needs to be done? What can be done? To discuss the art of the possible in Canada, we're joined by Avi Lewis. He has worked as a journalist and broadcaster and is the director of the film This Changes Everything, based on the recent book of the same name written by his partner, Naomi Klein. He's also one of the architects and supporters of a major call to arms called The Leap Manifesto, which was announced at the same time as the film got screened at the Toronto Independent Film Festival. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, Avi Lewis.
Thank you so much. I wish I was there with you in Winnipeg, because it's a city at the heart of our country that knows much about issues of climate change and inequality, and that's exactly what our work is focused on.
So, looking at the film, it seems like there's a very important focus, a theme running through the whole film, having to do with the way the narrative. There's a certain narrative that seems to be acting as a kind of a mental block, and that your film, as I see it, seems to focus on reframing the whole climate change situation. How would you describe the actual narrative that's been dogging us that we need to restructure?
Well, you've gone right to the heart of the kind of big idea of the film, And I should point out that Naomi started writing this book and I started making the film at the same time. So this is Naomi Klein, the writer who is my partner in life as well as a partner in this project, wrote this book called This Changes Everything. And I made a film called This Changes Everything. And they're explorations of the same terrain around the connections between climate change and the economic system, or the carbon in the air and the economic system that put it there, as we say in the film. But they're very, very different works. And they happen in parallel. I didn't have the book. It's not an ad, the film is an adaptation of the book. So this idea at the core of the film that composes the real intellectual clothesline that the stories in the film hang on, Naomi's narration, focuses in on this 400-year-old story that we've been telling ourselves as Western society since the Enlightenment, since, you know, Sir Francis Bacon and the Scientific Revolution, this idea that humans can control and extract from nature without end and without consequences. And, you know, it obviously it seems like a very silly idea when you just state it baldly. But when you think about the way the global economy is depleting our finite resources and all of the multiple overlapping crises that's creating, we're still acting in our society like we can, that nature is a machine that we can, and we are the engineers, that we can just do things to nature. And climate change isn't just an issue, it's a message from the earth telling us that we have to work in concert with nature, not see nature as a resource to be infinitely exploited. And of course, indigenous people have known this for many, many thousands of years, and there are alternative stories through which different cultures see their place in the world. But our dominant culture of corporate capitalism and the way that it works around the world today is based on this 400-year-old story, and it's a very destructive one. So in the film, that's sort of the thread, the big idea. But what the experience of watching the film is not like a lot of talking heads, blah, 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 although there is some of that. but really there are a series of stories from community struggles around the world, from Canada and the United States, in Europe, in China and India, where people are, where these big ideas are actually playing out in people's real lives. And there, you know, a lot of communities on the front lines of fossil fuel extraction and other projects like that, who are, you know, confronting the way that this big idea actually plays out on their land, and they get organized to do something about it. And those dramatic struggles are really the heart of the film.
Yeah. I mean, just to, I'm just looking at it. It seems to me, though, that this whole, the story of domination and control, in a sense, it goes back even further. I mean, when you consider the agricultural revolution and the rise, you know, the colonialism and so on. But if I'm understanding like the importance of that 400-year benchmark, it's that when our people, when you know, Europeans and then later other peoples realize that, hey, we can actually realize this. It's not like we're as much at the mercy of the natural world as we used to be.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. I mean, it's been really striking to be here in New York during the Pope's visit to the United States because, of course, the Pope wrote this, released this extraordinary document called Laudato Si, the papal encyclical, on these very issues. And that notion that you referred to that we take up in the Leap Manifesto of a society based on caring for each other and the earth is very much at the heart of the Pope's encyclical, which deals a lot with climate change. And it's a reminder that, you know, this is an Old Testament version of humans' place in the world. And many people coming from this Judeo-Christian heritage have long believed that God gave man the earth, and I use the gendered pronoun intentionally there, to do with what he will. You know, that the man is, God gave the earth to people, to, you know, and all the animals are subservient to us and everything is there for our enjoyment and use. And so this story, you're quite right, goes back way further. And it was fossil fuels and the industrial exploitation of fossil fuels and the steam engine around 400 years ago that really put this worldview into practice. That's when as the rise of industrial society just turned into a supernova of development, you know, this is when we really detached from nature in Western society. And, you know, it even used to be that factories had to be near rushing waters because water wheels were how factories were powered before fossil fuels. Fossil fuels meant that ships could go anywhere, anytime. We didn't have to worry about the wind. We could put factories wherever there were the cheapest pools of labor. So you really see that fossil fuels takes this idea and then carves out this story on the land and on our world, and takes this idea to very to extremes. You know, the pinnacle of which is the climate crisis, because that's when we started emitting greenhouse gases, and that's when the temperature started its inexorable climb. And this is why we need to look at this story now, because the climate crisis is the ultimate expression of the idea that there are no consequences for industrial activity. And so this is why it's time to do this deep renovation.
Yeah. So we have climate change and the ravages affecting the planet. And I think one could probably include things like genetic engineering and stuff going along with that. They're artifacts of this way of thinking. And I suppose capitalism itself is an artifact of, you know, springing out, like these little shoots coming out of this story. Or do we see, you know, the climate crisis and the environmental and biodiversity and all these other effects as consequences of capitalism itself?
Well, you know, it's a bit chicken and egg, but I think, you know, this is one of Naomi's great skills as a writer, is that she's a pattern recognizer. You know, we see these stories repeat, and we see the thinking, which is so similar behind so many of these different phenomena. And, you know, we go to Greece in the film, and there's an extraordinary community struggle against a Canadian gold mine in a beautiful part of northern Greece, where this huge gold processing plant, proposed plant, would clearly devastate the whole hydrology of the region, would be affected. You know, they're going to put the gold processing plant, like, right on the watershed. What could possibly go wrong? How many times have we seen this story play out? In Greece today, which we know has had brutal austerity policies forced on it by European institutions, driven, you know, by the government of Germany in many ways. Mm-hmm. This is the reason that's being given to people today in Greece for why they have to open the Aegean and Ionian seas to offshore oil drilling, why they need projects like this gold mine, why, you know, they have to sell off all of their, you know, basically everything now is on the auction block in Greece. All of the public institutions, the ports, the airports, the you know, whole islands, on banks, you know, everything is for sale. And this is a contemporary version of this logic that we see at work throughout the whole period where climate change has become a global crisis. This logic, you know, the market, this is the sort of new version of the God that has to control everything, where there is no limit to the exploitation. And, you know, we make a lot of connections in the work that we do, both within the film and the book and in our other political work, around austerity and the logic of austerity and cutting and the sectors that are valued in our economy and the sectors that don't have value. Because, you know, if we really want to deal with the climate crisis, we're going to have to transition as a society off of fossil fuels. Yeah. And that's going to take massive government spending in the right ways and, you know, with the right control, so that it's not just, you know, like a big government a la 1970s experiment, but actually looking at the energy transition in Germany, as we do in the film, that much of it can and should be community controlled. And this is, you know, this is why in Europe, and, you know, we've been living under austerity in Canada, although a lot of Canadians don't recognize how much our government has been cutting in the last 10 years. We need to eliminate that logic of endless cutting and market-driven priorities if we're going to respond to this crisis. And that's a good thing, because, you know, people in Winnipeg know that you need massive public reinvestment in healthcare and education and all the caring professions in daycare and long-term care. And that First Nations, who have had the worst deal in our Canadian economy for so many decades, need to be first in line when, you know, services and communities roll out, when good new jobs and renewable energy start to emerge, and that the opportunity here is huge as we make the transition to actually heal some of these wounds that go back to the founding of our country.
Well, what about the idea that, I mean, you if we, like, to borrow your own phraseology, if we're the free markets are gods, I mean, aren't our existing governments part of the clergy? And, like, what sense what sense does it make to engage those politicians when they seem to be kind of double-coupled to that story and are inclined, I would imagine, should they be sufficiently impressed about the urgency of the crisis, seek out the same kinds of solutions, like what you pointed out in the early stages of the film, that group, that the Royal Society with their solar radiation management and geoengineering, and we're going to use more and more technology, more of the same stuff, because this is our God and we dare not abandon it for fear of going to some sort of a hell, right? So, like,
right. This is exactly right. Like, this is the dilemma, and this goes to the heart of what it's become fashionable to call one theory of change, right? So we need government in order to make this massive transition. There's no question about it. Those resources are public resources. Government resources are public resources. They belong to all of us. And government is the expression, or in theory, is the expression of our common will and priorities as citizens. So there's no way that this is going to be done by the private sector. We can see that those pure market-based solutions are failing all over the world. But governments are captured, as you quite correctly point out, both by the logic of neoliberalism and austerity, and also by the belief in the techno fix and that idea that goes back to the Royal Society, that, you know, the human genius will solve all of these problems that human ingenuity has caused. And that's, you know, in common sense terms, that's ridiculous. We know that doesn't work. So how do we make change when our governments are captured? That's precisely why we launched the LEAP Manifesto and why we did it in the middle of an election campaign. And when I say we, I'm referring to a huge cross-section of different groups who came together in a meeting in May that Naomi and I helped to organize and convene. But it was a cross-sectoral meeting of First Nations, labor activists, anti-poverty and migrant rights activists. So a whole spectrum of social justice groups came together. And the manifesto is a sort of a policy roadmap to get Canada off fossil fuels in a hurry, in a justice-based way, so that this enormous economic activity that will be unleashed by the transition actually goes to making a fairer society, dealing with inequality and many other social overlapping social problems at once, multiple solutions to multiple problems through the same process. And, you know, we know that none of the major parties have this kind of bold vision on offer in the election, and that's precisely why this big coalition of different social justice groups came together to propose it, because we don't see in the political class the kind of imagination that is necessary to respond to these crises, these overlapping crises. And so citizens are standing up and proposing them. And the idea, and we take this from other examples of major changes in other countries, is to create power, political power behind this set of policies, initially by means of people signing a petition, but also people will use the manifesto as an organizing tool, even in the election. Some people want to put candidates on the spot to ask them about these specific policies. But in general, we have, you know, lots of different groups campaigning with this platform to try to build support and political power behind it, with the idea that it's perfectly likely that there'll be a coalition government in Canada after October 19th, at some point when they've done the wrangling, and that government is going to be looking around for policies that are popular. And if we can demonstrate that these radical policies that really respond to what science is telling us is necessary to respond to the climate crisis, but also that justice requires be done in this particular way. If we make those policies popular enough, we hope that we can provide them as a gift to a new government which is casting around for popular things to do. And we believe, when you look at Germany, and this is a brief, you know, it's only a minute in the film, but it's one of the most important minutes to me. We've seen a similar dynamic take place in an industrial democracy that has a lot of similarities with Canada. You know, Germany is not a small country. It's the biggest economy in Europe. And they've achieved an energy transition in Germany in a decade and a half that's got them to 30% renewables. And in the process, they've created 400,000 jobs. And perhaps more interestingly, there are now 900 energy cooperatives in Germany, where in many cases, communities have deprivatized, have taken back electricity utilities under public control, and they run them, renewable energy sold into the grid, with the revenues going directly back to those communities to pay for services. Now, there's lots of imperfect things about the German energy transition, and we think there are much more just and exciting ways to do it. But that basic model needs to be taken up in Canada in a dramatic way. And it didn't happen in Germany because the politicians just thought it would be cool. I mean, you have coalition governments in Germany that are led by conservatives, and none of this government intervention is from, you know, the Angela Merkel conservative playbook. It was pushed by enormous pressure from, you know, initially the anti-nuclear movement that fought for decades against nuclear power, turned the tide on that struggle, set its sights on getting Germany into renewables, and is now working to complete the job by getting Germany off coal. So you see a dynamic process between social movement power, ideas, policies, and a push coming from below, and governments responding to that because it's popular, because they feel the pressure, because there's a counter pressure to the continuous influence of big corporations and of the usual business logic. You get a pushback from citizens on the other side, and sometimes really good policy can result.
Okay, Avi Lewis, I really appreciate your sharing your perspectives and taking the time to speak with us. And we know you've got a number of screenings that will be taking place across Canada and eventually internationally. But again, congratulations on the film and on the managing to get the message out to even little leaks into the mainstream media, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
We appreciate your role and the role of community radio in sharing these alternative perspectives, and it's not just about the mainstream. We communicate in so many different ways these days, and it is exciting in the internet age to see the way that community radio still has such a strong voice and a strong role in sharing alternative ideas around the world, and so we salute the work that you do.
Okay. So thank you very much, Avi Lewis, and take care, and all the best to you and Naomi Klein.
Thank
as well.
You.
Okay. Avi Lewis is one of the individuals behind the Leap Manifesto and the director of the film This Changes Everything. The film recently premiered at the Toronto Independent Film Festival, where it earned the first runner-up spot for the Grolsch People's Choice Documentary Award. The film opens officially on October 9th in the following cities and places. In Montreal at Excentris at 3536 Saint-Laurent Boulevard. In Calgary at the Globe Cinema at 617 8th Avenue Southwest. In Coburg in The Loft at 201 Division Street. In Guelph at The Bookshelf at 41 Quebec Street. In Ottawa at the Mayfair Theatre at 1074 Bank Street. In Salmonarm, BC at the Salmar Classic Theatre at 360 Alexander Street Northeast. In Toronto at the TIFF Bell Lightbox at 350 King Street West. In Vernon, BC at the Vernon Town Cinema at 2910 30th Avenue. In Victoria at the Vic Theatre at 808 Douglas Street. In Waterloo at the Princess Twin Cinema at 46 King Street North. And in Winnipeg at the Bandwidth Theatre at 585 Ellis Avenue. For more details on the film and opening day screenings, go to thischangeseverything.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Okay, so we're joined right now by Dar Jamail. Dar Jamail is a writer with truthout.org and has been focusing a lot of his attention lately on the concept of abrupt climate disruption. So, Dar Jamail, thank you very much for joining us. I know that you've put out several articles on this subject, including a couple over the summer. And we did have you on last December. Maybe you'd like to, first of all, just bring us up to date on some of the recent developments that the public really needs to focus on if we're going to be responding in a responsible way to the crisis.
Well, I think the main point that I would want to impress upon people is just how fast things are happening now in regards to climate disruption. I've been writing a monthly dispatch where I survey all the latest scientific reports coming out on the subject, as well as all the evidence that's playing itself out on the planet in front of our eyes in the form of droughts and extreme weather events and things of this nature. And most recently, I would say that, you know, things are, of course, speeding up faster than ever. You know, this year is by far and away, according to climate scientists, going to be the hottest year ever recorded. 14 of the 15 hottest years ever recorded have all occurred since the year 2000. Another report came out very recently that showed just since 1970, half of all life in the oceans, including fish, oceanic birds, et cetera, is gone. So another report that came out a few months ago at this point that showed officially we are now in the sixth mass extinction event in the planet's history, this one being unique, and it was one caused by us because of climate disruption and other things that we've done, like overfishing, deforestation, overpopulation, et cetera. So these things are basically moving along at warp speed at this point. And so nothing short of an immediate full-scale response, meaning governments getting involved in issuing mandates of regulations, things of this nature, you know, nothing short of that kind of a dramatic response would make any sense at this point to address the issue.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you've also, in one of your articles, quoted a study that talked about ocean acidification likely to worsen, and that there's, even with carbon sequestration and cleanup efforts beginning immediately in an immediate and dramatic fashion, that there's really not much that could be done to halt that, right?
That's true, and that really could be said for most any issue, not just ocean acidification. But that said, there is still some chance that if we did have the kind of dramatic, broad-scale response that would have to happen to address the issue, that we could still at least possibly mitigate it somewhat. And so we're not going to stop it, we're not going to change it, but if we can even take actions that are going to take some of the edge off for future generations, we are morally obliged to do so. It's just simply the right thing to do. So I feel like no matter what, even if all the evidence shows that we're on set to surpass even all the worst case predictions for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports say, which we are, then we're still absolutely morally obliged to do everything in our power to try to address the situation the best we can.
Okay. So, I mean, would it be accurate to say that you're hopeful that if we really roll up our sleeves and get to work, that we can at least mitigate the crisis?
I think that it's a given that if we had a global mandated response of literally we are going to shut down use of fossil fuels almost completely, only to use them in very, very limited circumstances to produce renewable energy like solar panels, wind, wave energy, et cetera, only to produce those that type of infrastructure and literally clamp down on a global scale in a very immediate and dramatic way. I have no doubt that that would have an impact and that at least in theory, is possible, you know, as in I'm not obviously by far it, in a way the first person to discuss this, but, you know, the biggest obstacle facing us is not can we do it. The biggest obstacle facing us is the lack of political will across the globe, both in your country and mine, for two very good examples.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to things like these feedback loops, where you have you know, the hotter things get, the hotter things are gonna, you know, the more things are gonna continue to unravel. Whether we're talking about you know, methane releases from the Arctic or what have you, like how could those things conceivably be reversed? Given, you know, in terms of what we as Canadians or what the world community, world governments could possibly do to affect these things. I mean, do you still rule out things like geoengineering as one of the options to explore?
Well, geoengineering, every serious climate scientist I've spoken with is in great fear of it. In fact, we even have examples of some scientists who came out initially as proponents of geoengineering who have since changed their mind and said, no, this is the unseen ramifications of this and the feedback loop that this type of engineering could cause and likely would cause are so scary that there's no way we should touch it. I mean, you know, one example of a failed geoengineering, inadvertent geoengineering example I would point to is what we're talking about is, you know, when we have literally engaged in an industrial project, i.e. industrialization, that has pumped so much CO2 and other gases into the atmosphere, we've literally changed the composition of the atmosphere of the planet, and the unintended consequences are why we're having this conversation. And so that's just one example. You know, these other ideas of, you know, basically doing things like putting lead in the oceans to increase the amount of CO2 they can contain, to spraying sulfur or tiny droplets in the air over the Pacific to increase the brightness of clouds to reflect sunlight. All of these bring with them unintended consequences that we just don't know what's going to happen. Unfortunately, it does look as though as things continue to unravel on the ground and things get worse and worse and we have increasingly dramatic examples of what's happening to the planet, governments are going to come under increasing pressure to employ things like geoengineering practices, and that's a very worrisome thing indeed. I haven't seen one serious climate scientist or anyone in NASA so far that I've been talking to that would advocate using something like geoengineering because of the unintended consequences that we just don't know, and there's nothing to indicate so far that there would be one way to use it that would guarantee to be safe and not kick off any of these unforeseen, unintended consequences or feedback loops.
Now, you said that, I mean, there are things that can be done politically, but it's or that can be done technically to mitigate the crisis, but not the question is whether there's that political will to make that particular leap. But isn't at least one complicating factor the idea that so much of the infrastructure of our various societies, economically and politically, seem to be double coupled to that whole mindset that welcomes something like geoengineering and business as usual, a certain built-in inertia that has to be overcoming. How could you see that inertia being overcome? Is it a question of a bottom up, you know, the public kind of pushing their politicians, or I mean, how is that? How would you guide concerned people to begin to effect those sorts of changes? Protest.
Well, that's a very important point, because I think that's probably the a close second to the biggest obstacles facing us is that people are unwilling to change their lifestyles and that exact inertia that you just spoke of. And so I think the other thing that people have to understand is we have to do this ourselves by changing our own lives. I think petitioning the government for reform at this point, that's been happening now for decades. Watch what will happen up and come up in front of the Paris talks in November with the upcoming international climate conference there. We're going to see probably the biggest demonstrations ever. We're going to see all kinds of stuff in the press of you know, famous people, actors, celebrity journalists, et cetera, making their pitch as to what needs to happen. And we're going to see the same results. Governments basically throwing out a bone and not doing enough to really affect the change. When in reality, what has to happen is an organic grassroots level movement of people literally taking things upon their own shoulders to start changing their lifestyles and stop emitting CO2 into the atmosphere. And so that means, and I'm actually seeing some of this happening already up around where I live in Washington State, where there are entire communities. Granted, these are small and on a very local level, but communities that are taking it upon themselves to get off of fossil fuels, start growing their own food, stop traveling, stop using jets, things like this. And that's, you know, that's what needs to happen on a global scale. But I think the answer will begin in a very, very local way.
Okay. I wanted to maybe get you to focus on right now on the Canadian situation where, because we've got a federal election at the moment. And what I seem to be what I find myself hearing from all the various politicians is they do all seem to be paying lip service to the need to address climate change, but at the same time they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. Is I guess we can have growth, but we can also do it in a sustainable, environmentally friendly way. What are your thoughts about like the what we may need to do, maybe perhaps unique to Canada? I mean, since I know that you've written a lot about some of the changes that are happening right here in the country with wildfires and whatnot, but you know, what do you think? What would you expect? What would your policy prescription be for that politician or political party that you could put your gold star on or green star, as it were, and say, okay, that is an acceptable policy for a Canadian national government?
Well, and this is going to sound like an absolute pipe dream, but it's just going to be in theory, and I don't think it has any chance of being a reality, given that most of, and again, I'm not familiar with all the candidates. Maybe there is someone, but certainly all the larger ones that are with the more well-funded backers behind them what we would need to see is someone that would stand up and say, you know, we are immediately instituting policies that are going to get this country off of fossil fuels. This is what that is going to look like. We are going to rein in, you know, stop the deforestation, meaning stop the logging, because that is also another huge factor in what's sending us over the edge. Deforestation, things like this, overuse of resources. Obviously, the tar sands has to be stopped immediately, and reclamation efforts begun in that area to get the land back something like it used to be, if that's even possible. Just for starters, you know, things, you know, immediate, broad scale, dramatic shifts in policy, because what has to stop happening is CO2 being emitted the way it's being emitted. So immediate, dramatic policies that are going to address that, and taking this as seriously as it needs to be taking, and then lining out the reasons to the general public as to why, you know, talking about how far along we are, citing scientific reports, and these are things coming out of places like NASA. This is not, you know, half-baked stuff coming out of bloggers and garages, but, you know, leading scientific institutions like NASA and reports published in Nature Climate Change and Proceedings for National Academy of Sciences, and talking to people as adults, talking to people as though they have minds and are discerning, and talking about to people as though they really do care what is going to happen and understand what needs to happen for us to legitimately address this issue. And so until there is a candidate that comes close to, and I mean very close to addressing it in that dramatic of a way, in that adult of a way, in that mature of a way, in that honest of a way, I it's just going to be business as usual and we can keep going off the cliff.
I mean, it sounds like you're talking about the dramatic actions. This is essentially the theme of what's been released by a nonpartisan group. It's called the Leap Manifesto, and I believe you've had a chance to look at it or are somewhat familiar with it. I was wondering if you might have some comments or caveats attached to that particular approach to focusing the attention of the public and policymakers on this urgent situation.
I definitely think any action that draws attention to this issue and the immediacy of it and how important it is a good thing. Anything that's going to bring it more further into the media and get people talking about it and thinking about it. But again, I think the solution at this stage of the game lies on a local level because, again, pushing reform, trying to push a government to do the right thing, knowing that the government is, ours perhaps more here in the U.S. more so than up in Canada, but that, the leading industrialized countries at this point who are emitting so much of the CO2 are, basically fossil fuel funded. I mean, if you look at who backs politicians down here, you're going up against one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S. that's ever existed, never will exist. And so I think petitioning a system to reform that is already inherently run and connected to and dependent upon the thing that it's trying to change is a fool's errand. And so I would, again, encourage people to just start, taking matters into our own hands. What can I do right here on a local level to stop emitting CO2 and start from there? And again, that might sound daunting and overwhelming or even futile, but it is already starting to happen in a lot of places around the planet. And I think that instead, perhaps energy should be focused more on that instead of repeating the same thing over and over, i.e., petitioning governments to reform and getting the same result.
Mm. What are your thoughts about what's being referred to as the green economy?
Well, again, I think, that's my answer would be tied into what you mentioned earlier about things like sustainable development. I mean, I kind of see these as oxymorons because the thing is business as usual can't continue. Trying to still push an economy or an energy use strategy where we're still all consuming as much as we are now and traveling as much as we are now, it's just not going to work, meaning we have to change our lifestyles in the West. We have to get away from flying. We have to get away from driving. We have to get away from importing food from all over Kingdom Come. Things of this nature. That means living more simply. That means living more locally. And until that is really literally going to be the only way that we're going to see a dramatic drop in emissions that we have to be seeing at this point. And again, I know that sounds pretty out there and pretty dramatic and perhaps even undoable, but that's from my perspective, looking at all the science that's coming out on a monthly basis, and I've been doing this for years now, that is where we are, because we do not have any more time. We cannot afford to emit any more at this stage of the game. We have to have dramatic changes happening immediately. We are literally in a life-threatening situation. But again, I think on a local level, each of us individually can start moving in that direction immediately, and that would be a good start.
What are your instincts about mobilizing people to act? I mean, you can mobilize people through fear and say, well, this is what's going to happen. I mean, there's going to be chaos and this is what's happening now. Or maybe some sorts of like articulating an alternative vision that might bring about that might be attractive, like sort of like a positive messaging. Do you have an opinion about how best to frame the message that could mobilize people to act?
Well, certainly fear doesn't work. I put out my information in hopes that people will just simply see it and understand the gravity of the situation and behave accordingly. And behave in a way that makes sense and is logical. Because, I guess another way that people could look at it is that by living locally and taking matters into our own hands and living our lives in the way that I just described is actually way more healthy physically, psychologically, spiritually, and it's consequently also the better thing to do for the planet and the better thing to do for future generations. That if we're all living much more responsibly and mindfully and closer to the earth, it's just simply the right thing to do. We're going to be happier and healthier, and so is the planet. And so that would be another way to put it. And, there is data to support that, that if you look at, the happiness indexes and psychological well-being and physical health well-being of people in the so-called industrialized world and so-called more advanced world, as opposed to those farmers, for example, living in developing countries that have not even a quarter of the comforts available to them that we do in the West, they are actually stronger, happier, healthier, and living much more fulfilled lives. So there is even scientific data to back that up in a lot of studies that have been done. They're not the ones with half their populations on psychotropic medications like here in the U.S. Because the system just doesn't work.
I just also wanted, in terms of models that could be followed, we look at the country, like in the recent film This Changes Everything, based on Naomi Klein's book of the same name. There was much mention of Germany and the example that they are pioneering with regard to pursuing renewables and getting off of nuclear. Again, do you have any should we be focusing more on that example? Is that something that would be appropriate for other nations to follow?
Well, certainly a country on a broad scale going to far more solar, as Germany has, is a great thing. But again, I don't think it's realistic to try to move entire countries over to that, because again, you're going to run up against lack of political will and things like that. I mean, Germany, there's other major problems that it has alongside solar. There's still a long, long ways off to shifting entirely away from fossil fuel use. And we can look at the size of their military and point to that as one example, and things that they're involved in internationally with that military. So there's, again, looking at it from a country perspective, I think, is not – it's pie-in-the-sky stuff. I just don't think it's realistic. I think, spending energy to try to petition countries to change, that's been going on for decades. Yes, it's ramping up now. Yes, it's getting more attention. But there's yet to be one example of success on that front. So I think, again, I just want to keep the focus on a local level and what can people in communities do, because it's certainly doable, and there are success stories for that. I mean, there's another country in Germany that on its own decided it's a small town in Germany of about 3,000 people that decided on its own, they saw the writing on the wall, they saw what was coming, and they said, look, we're going to go 100% renewable. And so they did that. They set themselves up in that capacity, solar, wind, other renewable methods. And for now, several years in a row, they have overproduced their own energy to where they are 100% off the grid, and then they sell their excess energy to nearby towns and then use that money to take care of their own infrastructure needs. So, again, on a local level, it's feasible and it's doable and it is happening. And I think that's where we need to start, because, I guess I'm kind of going back to that old saying, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. And I think that that's where we're at with this, because, again, petitioning governments to change, been there, done that, same results. And I think that that's going to continue in the future, because we have to remember who owns the government.
And that gets me to the next point in terms of who owns not only the government, but media and the mechanisms by which certain sorts of portraits of the world are presented. I mean, this radio program is an exception, hopefully. But for the most part, the messaging, the news, the stories, popular culture, you have such a huge role of the profit-making companies that are, you might say, are literally invested in the continued desecration of the planet. So what are your thoughts? I mean, certainly I appreciate any plugs, but, you know, how could we disrupt that whole messaging system that moves the focus away from the localization efforts that you're pioneering, for example, or just the bad news that just seems to be coming out every week?
Well, my entire line of work has depended upon the importance of independent media. You know, I mean, I've started my journalism career by sending myself to Iraq on my own money and just blogging and reporting to independent outlets and non-corporate outlets like Democracy Now! In the U.S., for example. And so I think that it's just a matter of continuing to do what we keep doing. And again, using Iraq as an example, things were so bad on the ground over there shortly after the occupation began that despite the whitewashing given in the U.S., particularly in the corporate media of the situation and trying to portray it as being otherwise, eventually, thanks to independent journalists, and I was by far and away not the only one, more independent outlets reporting on what was actually happening, helped along by how bad things got so quickly over there that inevitably, even just within a few years, it had started to enter the mainstream dialect and discourse of, oh, actually the occupation's a failure and it's not working and something has to change. And so I would say on a longer time scale, perhaps the same thing can happen regarding climate disruption, where, you know, things are getting so bad and it's undeniably so that, and thanks in large part to programs like this, me writing for an independent outlet and Truthout and others doing similarly, that the word is getting out there on a more local level, coupled with the evidence on the planet being so undeniable at this point and continuing to be so with each passing day. Those two things working in concert, I think, are starting to affect that change, because even here in the U.S., I am starting to see not fully honest reporting, but more honest reporting, even starting to kind of seep into the mainstream outlets at this point. And that's continuing. And I think that that will continue and it will increase over time. And that's why we all have to just keep doing what we're doing.
Dr. Jamil, I really want to thank you for sharing those thoughts and insights with us. And we look forward to more of your articles in the future.
Well, thank you. It's been great talking with you.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail, a Truthout staff reporter. He's been doing extensive research and writing on the subject of abrupt climate disruption.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.